developed pneumonia shortly after my birth, and I was watched over carefully day and night for quite a period of time. They placed onion poultices on my little chest in order to help me with my breathing. These 16 neighbors became so attached to me, they all wanted to name me. So my mom gave them the privilege. Here I am, stuck with 16 double names, a total of 32 in all. Woe is me. At the age of 3 years, I was taught my 32 names. I still have a vivid memory of them. They were all old-fashioned names. I'm proud of them, and I'm also happy to have survived such an ordeal under profound circumstances. The home I was born in still stands, and it is over 100 years old, and one of my sisters and her husband live there. Many fond and happy memories will always be there at the home place. Our parents taught us self-perseverance and to be independent and proud and honest. We were taught to work from early childhood and to share with others. It took all of these to survive. We improvised a lot for things we needed and also for our entertainment. My grandfather, my father, my brother, my late husband, my son, nephews and nieces were all coal miners, and some of them still are. And they also helped to form the older ones. My grandfather and my father helped to form the unions. I would travel with them as a child to rallies, and I'd get up on the podium and sing with all my heart the union songs. I was so thrilled to be a part of their participation. It was rough, though. Times were bad, just as times are bad now. The coal companies don't like unions. They want to hog all the profits. They'd much rather have the miners to be scabs. The companies hired yellow dogs to beat up on the men if they tried to stop scabs from going to work. It was a real hellish battle. Oh, I remember it well. Today, I think the coal companies would still prefer non-union workers. It is my opinion the reason most of the mines are idle is to make it so rough on the coal miners and their families that they'll be so desperate and go back to work for scab wages and have no UMWA. But the companies evidently don't know the strength and brains of our coal miners. They'll never break the union. They'll stand together, and they will never, never break the union, even though the companies would like to see it happen. Communications are very bad between companies and unions. The companies must be humanized. Some couldn't care less for the coal miners' survival and their lives. There has been so many lives lost with coal mine tragedies. It's heartbreaking. Negligence is the word, and negligence is a crime. I've seen many children raised without a father. All the burdens were placed on the poor mother in rearing the children. What a shame. We must all be made aware of each, and each of us has a responsibility to help change things and to keep fighting for our human rights and human dignity. It's a continuous and perpetual struggle, but we must not despair. It's pathetic how the poor people are always put at the bottom of the list. And I tell you, we're getting tired of getting the part of the chicken that goes over the fence last. That's the way our society is. As you've been told before and read about, 78 widows lost their husbands in a consolidation coal mine tragedy. It was on a Wednesday morning, November 20th, 1968. And there were 235 children left fatherless. It was the Farmington No. 9 mine tragedy. However, it didn't happen at Farmington, it happened above Farmington. And it happened at Mannington. It was so traumatic for all of us. I remember that day as though it were yesterday. I was alone, waiting for my husband to come from work. And of course, he worked on a midnight shift. It was about 7:20 a.m. I was sitting there crocheting an afghan. I wanted to get it done for Christmas. And I was waiting on him. I had his, well, I always made him like a cup of instant coffee because he liked to read the paper and he liked to have his coffee before he took a shower. He showered at home. And I had his orange juice and his vitamin ready to take to him. I turned the Today Show on. That's where I learned about that tragedy. And the reason the mine blew up is because they were so hoggish for coal and the fan was down, and they want to cover that all up. The fan was down. If they would have let the men know, every one of them could have walked out and they would have been alive. Because it's much easier to accept a natural death or someone being ill and knowing that God's going to take them than it is to have lived through a tragedy or face a tragedy. It's so shocking. It's so much trauma involved, and it's just rough. It's still rough. I was, as I told you, I was alone, and I heard it on the NBC Today Show. The company never, ever sent anyone to our home to tell us or to say I'm sorry. And to this day, they haven't apologized. So that's the way they treat their employees and the families. After I became composed, I thought of forming an organization. And another widow, Mary Rogers, she had the same idea. So we decided to get in touch with all the other widows and the children and all, and call a meeting. So we held, we needed all the moral and spiritual support that we could get because we were faced with the same thing in common of losing our loved ones there and wondering if they were going to recover them. Because it was 10 days, they kept the mine open, they said. But all along, they were carrying a shell and gravel and everything and really sealing it up. That's how dirty they were. Then they called us all in this church on the 10th day. The president of the company, it was John Corcoran. Yeah, John Corcoran from Pittsburgh. He came, and Tony Boyle was there too. He said that was the safest mine. It was never safe because the gas content and methane was terrible. And they had had other explosions too. So they came, and of course there wasn't a dry eye, and many people, many of our widows and children had to have psychiatric help. But by me, I think, helping to form this organization, becoming involved and wanting to help them, wanting to help the coal miners and help people everywhere, which it opened doors throughout the world, this number 9 mine tragedy. And I think that God just gave me the grace and the courage and the strength, and I didn't need to even take a nerve pill. Praise the Lord for that. And So we met regularly, monthly, and if there need to be any meetings called in between, they were there. We met regularly in a local 4042 Union Hall where the men were members. And it was quite a distance that we traveled. We traveled through the cold and you know, all kinds of weather to get there. And anything that we would hear, we kept a close vigil to, on what the lies and everything they were putting us through and what all they did to us. So we kept a close vigil too on them. And so anything that would come up, we would get together and have a meeting. And we were very close. We were very, and we still are. It'll be 15 years, November 20th. And we're all very close, no matter if some of them live far away. Just to snap your finger, get on the phone, we can get in touch with them. We widows were also a part of helping to get the federal coal mine health and safety law passed. However, even though it was passed, it must always be enforced. You just got to keep fighting and fighting to keep after. Because Secretary of the Department of the Interior, he often likes to put the coal miners at the bottom of the list too. And he'll lie too, because we met with him several times too. And he wrote a book, Who Owns America? He sent the book to me and autographed it. And in this book he had a chapter written on we widows. And he said, we came to his office unannounced and unexpected. And he told a damn lie, because I sent him a telegram and I have his reply by telegram in my possession, where he told us where to come, what day and what room and everything. So I wrote to the publishers, and I said, I went, not another book published until he corrects that. And I made a trip to Alaska, because he used to be governor of Alaska, Wally J. Hickel. And I called him. But you know, he didn't have the courtesy to invite me into his office and to face me. He didn't. But it was never too far to get to him. I'll tell you, that's true, because nobody walks on us, and you people don't ever let anyone walk on you. If you believe in something, stand up for it, because if you don't, you're going to lose your birthrights. You stand up for what you believe in and be counted, and don't let anybody pull the wool over your eyes, I'll tell you. You can learn a lot from what we've gone through, because it was rough. I mean, many incidents that were just so difficult, we wondered how we'd ever get them done. But I always encouraged my group. I always tried to keep them enthused. And I said, we can do it. We can climb the highest mountain if we have to. Never give in to something you believe in, especially these big coal companies or big companies, anything you're affiliated with. If you know you are right, do not give in to them. That's what they want. They want to wear you down, make you tired and weary. Maybe I'd be tired at the end of the day, but Lord, when I got up that next day, I just had more pep than, oh, I don't know where it came from. Then Carter has liver pills. I tell you, it's true. I did. So I delegated some of the widows, and we traveled to Washington, D.C. to lobby for the change. We made many trips to Washington, D.C., many trips. And I remember once it was so cold, and I was supposed to be there at the Federal Coal Mine Health and Safety hearing. I was supposed to testify. And I was actually scared to death, you know, to go on the plane. But they had to charter a plane, because the plane that was coming couldn't land. So they chartered a little dinky plane. Oh my God. I was so frightened. And just myself and Congressman Ken Heckler. Oh, he's an angel, I tell you. He's a fighter. And he's a very humane person, too. He was in Congress for around 18 years. And he ran for governor only to be defeated by Rockefeller. And he would have made an excellent governor. He really would have. He cared about people like all of us here. And he loved West Virginia. So anyway, I traveled in this plane. And there was a reporter, Ray Martin from Dominion News. And the pilot and me and Ken Heckler. And man, I tell you, I wasn't relaxed at all. I just held on and we just bumpity bump because we had a lot of turbulence. It was snowing. Well, you could imagine when a big plane can't land and a little plane up there. But you know, we made it. I said a lot of prayers on the way. And God took care of us. Well, we made the several trips to D.C. to lobby for the changes in the Federal Coal Mine Health and Safety Bill. And it was a difficult task. We weren't experienced and polished like the attorneys and representatives of our government. We were just little greenhorns, just widows that were frightened to death. Well, we'd been places and we'd read, we'd gone to school, but just to go into the big cities and everything, you know, and getting before all those people and trying to speak. But I just said a prayer and I said, "Dear Lord, here I am in this big chair. And give me the courage and give me the wisdom." And I'll tell you, there wasn't a dry eye, them senators and all of them that were sitting up there listening. The time I got through, it really got to them. I told them the facts. And, you know, what we were up against, what all the coal miners were up against, and how they were mistreated, and that they didn't have enough, didn't have rock dust, didn't have the things to support the roof. That's why so many roof falls into mines and kill the men. There's so many things that they needed in the mines that they weren't doing. Because in the Department of the Interior, which they had a big say over everything, they were just putting the miners at the bottom of the list. Probably they were being paid off, who knows, by the coal companies. And some wee widows were there in the Oval Office of the President of the United States the day the bill was signed into law. And we have the fountain pens that were used to sign the December 30th, 1969 Federal Coal Mine Health and Safety Bill. Nixon, Tricky Dick, he signed the bill. And he really didn't want to. There was a lot of, we had to pressure a lot and lobby a lot. And he shook hands with me, and it was like shaking hands with a eel. Cold, clammy, man, not sincere at all.
Did he have anything to say to you?
He said, "Well, I gotta get over to, where is it, St. Clemente, California." He had to go over there, that's where he lives. So, I said, "Well," I held him like this. I said, "You don't go till you sign that bill. That's what we came here for." And I know he's embarrassed. I was embarrassed too, in a way, but I never let him know, I'll tell you. It's true. He was the President of the United States, but I was a person too. And so were our husbands persons. And I felt so alone as I testified at the Federal Coal Mine Health and Safety hearing. But I was elated to know, even though it was too late for us, it wasn't too late for the future coal miners and their families. We traveled several times, just innumerable times, to Charleston to lobby for Black Lung. And I remember that we had signs, and there was a coffin. We had a dummy in the coffin they die from pneumoconiosis, the coal miners. So much dust and everything. So we had enough courage to do that, and we marched, I don't know how many times, around the rotunda and to let them know that we were there. And then we lobbied with all the legislators, and ours included, you know, and we were really busy. But finally, we made them aware, and so then when they were in session, of course, then they did something about it, because if they didn't, they wouldn't get in office again. Never.
Weren't a lot of the mines out on strike?
And the mines were out on strike, too. And, of course, a lot of miners were there, and, of course, a lot of our good friends that were in office that really cared about people, they were there. And, let's see, I think Archie Moore was governor then. Oh, Jesus. We went to his office, and you know, they more or less just showed us the door. But I didn't leave till I was ready to leave. I came there for a purpose, and let me tell you, we stayed until he heard us. Whether it went in one ear and out the other, I'll never know, but at least they knew we were there. But we were ladies all the way. We were. We were ladies all the way. We never caused any, you know. All we did was bring about awareness.
They brought about awareness. Like I said, it sounded like a freight train.
Yeah, right.
All those people. The
all I did was pound on the desk, you know, just gently.
The legislature.
Like a bowl of thunder.
Legislature had never seen anything like it. That's true.
I attended an awful lot of black lung meetings all over the state of West Virginia. And I was secretary of the Black Lung Association in Marion County when it was first formed, until it became terminated, in other words. But I worked very hard on that, too.
You know, Sarah, I bet a lot of these people here don't know what black lung is, and that a lot of the medical profession used to deny that it even exists. Could you tell them a little bit about...
Well, your lungs, they become very, very hard, just like a rock. Because, see, I saw pieces of them. And they are, full of holes. You can't breathe. It's just like as if your liver would go bad or your lungs go bad, and then you just... Oh, have you ever seen people trying to breathe to get their breath? The coal miners? It's pathetic, I'll tell you. Pathetic, because I really made appointments in myself, took my car and took thousands of coal miners to Beckley, to the Appalachian Hospital there, to Dr. Rasmussen, who's a pulmonary specialist. And I took them there, introduced them to the doctor, and they stayed at one place, and I stayed at a motel, afraid to move, slept with my clothes on, but God took care of me.
Why were you
and waited
afraid?
Till the well, because I was afraid, because when you work for something that you know is right, the white hats and a lot of people get after you. They do. They get after your life's in danger. Mm-hmm. And my life's been in danger a lot of times. Really has. In different campaigns that I've worked on and everything. Well, I lived alone 7 years, and I received many, many threatening calls. And I would get up maybe 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, turn all the lights on everywhere, and just pray, get on my knees and pray that God would take care of me. And I never ran away from anything, and He took care of me. People say, come live with me, come live with me. But I felt more secure in my own home. And then I knew I had to live alone, and so I wanted to master that, you know. And I did. And let me tell you, it wasn't easy. Because one morning, it was about 4 o'clock, and I was sleeping, and a phone rang. Some anonymous caller said, is Pete there? And I have a son, Pete Jr., I call him. And I was so alarmed that I said, Pete who? And they said, death comes to your house. Well, I knew I hadn't done anything to anybody. I've never been arrested. I've never done anything vicious to anybody in my life. The only thing I've done is just to do things to let people know that I care about them. And I just got a lot of letters from people that were unkind. I got a lot of letters that were nice. I got a lot of letters of offers of marriage, which, you know, I had enough sense to know that I don't go to a stranger. And not all of our widows knew that, too, that they would never do that.
They all got these proposals, didn't they?
Many of them, and I got so many.
They were going to collect all this money.
See, they thought that we had a lot of money. We lost our security, so how could we have a lot of money? So they thought we were rich, I guess, by things being publicized all over the nation and other countries. So we'd get calls, say, well, we'd like to have someone with 4 or 5 children. See, they were thinking that the widow would get Social Security, so that would give them something to live on. Well, the old suckers. If I had a hold of them, I'd really give it to them right now, too. And so we had enough sense to know that we wouldn't take up with strangers anyway. And I thought about Powers whenever he, from Quietdale, whenever he lured all those widows and took their monies and lured the kids and then killed them, put them in cement. And finally they got him. And on March the 18th, a few years back, they electrocuted him. That's when they used to electrocute people in West Virginia, when they had that law. And I said, well, you'll never get us. We don't need, they say, would you like to have a job? I said, what's wrong with the people over there in Ohio? Can't you get somebody to come over there and work? We got a job to do here. And then this guy said, well, I got a boat. I said, if you call again, I'm going to have you prosecuted. So he called again. It just happened some of the widows were at my home. So I called my minister, and he called him. He said, if you ever call Miss Kosnowski again, you definitely will be prosecuted. So we got rid of him. But we got calls say they like to have some widows certain sizes with certain size family and this and that. And I think I got more letters than anybody. And this one letter in particular was from California, and this guy said, dear Miss Kosnowski, I was inspired by you and your organization. And he said, I'm a man of the cloth, and I've preached for 32 years. He said, would you kind widows send me a lump sum of money so that we could buy a plot of land down south and build a kingdom for God? And so I had him checked out by the FBI. And you know, he never was a preacher. So he put P.S. He sent me a little book. The little pamphlet was a paperback. It said, just one word. And it says, P.S. Would you kindly send $2 for this? Why, I wouldn't send him a penny. And I didn't. None of us widows were taken like that. But see, they thought we had a lot of money. And it's hard to tell what they would have done to us had we been silly enough and inane enough to go over there and let them murder us. We were very alert, I'll tell you, even though we were sad. We stuck together, so. And we would advise one another what we should do. And some of us were in the documentary movie that won an Academy Award in the United States and France. The title of this movie was Harlan County, USA. Maybe some of you all saw it. It was going to be done all on number 9, but then something happened down in Harlan County, Kentucky, so they just combined it. And it was really good. And Barbara Koppel was the producer of it. And it was on national TV many, many times, and on drive-in theaters, and also on the radio. And it was aired all over the United States and other countries. And I was the chairperson of our number 9 widows organization. They appointed me, I don't know why. We struggled to recover our loved ones from deep down in the bowels of the earth, and we were fortunate to recover 59 men. And after 7 years, Dr. Urquhart at Fairmont General Hospital, the pathologist, he did an autopsy on some of them. They recovered. And Consolidation Coal Company tried to brainwash us and tell us that our husbands were cremated, and they weren't. So if they'd had a way out and had escapeways, they would have, they could have gotten out. Many of them could have, because I'm sure they barricaded themselves there. And I bet you they have notes, too. But you know, that's a terrible way to die, to be trapped 800 feet down under the bowels of the earth. And because it was the company's negligence. And I think about that. I think about, what if we were in this room and a fire or something broke out and we couldn't get out? Wouldn't that be terrible? Well, what about under the bowels of the earth where it's 800 feet deep? And then they don't have the, they aren't humane enough to recover them in so we can give them a decent burial. So I still fight them. We all do. Whatever affects one widow and children, it affects the other of our organization. Even though those widows that we fought so hard to the companies to recover their husbands, and they gave them a burial, decent burial, the best they could, and have a grave to go to, they still pray that we will recover ours. And some we widows are politically minded, and we care about how our government is run and who gets in office to govern our town and county and state and nation. And I was involved in politics in somewhere or other since the day I was eligible to vote. I registered voters and hauled voters to the polls, attended election rallies, and worked as an enumerator several times for the U.S. Census. And we campaigned all over the state and all over many other states for Jock Jablonski. He ran for United Mine Workers International President, and he really would have made a good president. He reminded me of John L. Lewis. But he met with tragic death, too. He and his wife and daughter were murdered just shortly after Christmas, 1969. And he was so proud of we widows, he called on us. And everywhere about he went, I was there, and I sat on the podium and always had something to tell the people. And he was so proud of us.
What would you tell him?
Well, I would tell them, you know, what was and what could be done if they helped to get Jock elected. He would never give in, you know. He didn't wear two hats like they do today. They tell you one thing, and then you go in a room and they'll tell the company one thing, and they'll come out and they'll tell the union men another thing. So that's wearing two hats. You can't wear two hats.
Wasn't Tony Boyle fighting against the black lung?
And Tony Boyle fought too. And you see where Tony Boyle is today? The poor man had everything going for him, and he's old, he's ill, and he's in prison. Because he's the one that mastered all these, what to do to kill the Jablonski family. And Kenny Jablonski That's Jock's son. He's an attorney, and Chip's an attorney. Chip used to be attorney for the UMWA under Arnold Miller. But he's an attorney in Washington, D.C. now. But anyway, Kenny is an attorney in Washington, Pennsylvania. And imagine he went there and found his dad and mother and sister. All of them murdered. That was really sad. So then the fight had to go on, so Arnold Miller was running. So then he came to my home. He hadn't had a stroke then. He was, you know, pretty able-bodied, except he had a black lung and one ear practically cut off in the war.
Some of these people that aren't from West Virginia may not know that Arnold Miller had been one of the leaders of the black lung.
Yeah, he was a leader of the black lung, too, because he had black lung. And he worked, you know, he was with the Miners for Democracy, too. He worked very, very hard. But now he's more or less incapacitated. He has a crippled leg from stroke and everything. But he was president of our United Mine Workers. And while he was president, well, we helped get him elected. And I'll tell you, we had to work hard. We worked every day from the grassroots to maybe 16 to 18 hours a day. You have to work hard if you want to get somebody elected that you know that could fill the shoes and do the job. You cannot sit around on your fanny and then to get somebody elected and then someone else get in and then complain about it. You got to get out and work, I'll tell you, kids. So Arnold sent me a telegram. He said, since you work so hard, I think you'd do well at the convention. So that was my first experience at the UMWA National Convention. I worked on the fund, setting up resolutions and everything to be adopted by the coal miners when they were voting, you know, on the floor. And I worked 17 days. Well, I had to get up, say, about 6 every morning and hurry up and eat a small bite and be in the room to start working about 8 o'clock. We worked 6, 7, 8, 9 o'clock mostly every evening for 17 days, but I enjoyed it. I learned so much, too. And I met so many nice people. And I met people in all walks of life. And I met coal miners from, you know, out west, and from Illinois, and from Kentucky, you name it.
This is right after Miller got elected.
Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about how the union was different after Miller got elected?
Well, it seemed like Harry Patrick, he was one of the officers, and Trbovich. It seemed like what the problem was, they all wanted to be president. And you cannot get along and have a good union and be a good leaders when you all want to fill that one shoe, you know? And they all want to, so they had difficulty there. And I think Trbovich, he would love to have been president, you know, other than Arnold. So then they sort of became enemies in a way. So I guess I think that's the reason why things didn't work out so well when Arnold was the leader, you know, it's because of that.
Everybody had their hopes up a lot. I know, you know, the union became democratic at that time.
Well, we fought for democracy in the union.
Yeah.
That's what we did.
Yeah.
And everyone struggled, and of course, whenever Trbovich gave a speech, you know, you would think he was sincere, but I'll never forget, I was the only widow of number 9 that went to the inauguration. And I'll never forget that day. I went, Trbovich couldn't wait to get up in his office and sit in that chair. He never even recognized me. He never said hello. Hello, Sarah. No way. He introduced his wife, he introduced his son to a gentleman that was sitting there, someone that they had hired in the PR, public relations, And boy, did that P.O. me. So, what happened to him? He had to have a leg amputated, and my heart aches for him. He now is only has one leg. So whenever you do wrong by people, something happens. But I don't wish anything to happen like that to anybody. No way. Then I got involved with the presidential candidate that was running for president, George McGovern. And he came, I know, he sent his representatives to my home about 5 times. And so we set up everything. I had a reception for he and his wife and met him at the airport and all. And he put me on his National Advisory Committee of the election. So I have a commode downstairs. And the bathroom upstairs was, well, down in the basement, I have a commode and shower. And so he said, I'd like to go to the restroom. And so I said, well, the other one is filled, but you can, I have one in the basement. So he went, and I was thinking, oh, if he became president, I was going to frame that. The president of the United States sat here. I'll tell you. And he got the nomination and at the National Convention in Florida. But who beat him? Tricky Dick. He beat him. And we have had the economy and everything has kept going down ever since he was in office. And it's worse now than it ever was. Depression all over the United States and other countries too. And what I do, I'll tell you, I set goals, and whenever I complete one, then I start on another. I think of something else that needs to be done, and it's just a continuous activity for me. Just somebody else needs something somewhere else, and or else I think of something. And I'll write to the representatives in Washington, make a suggestion. Sometime it works out. And we get on the ball, and usually there's some good Republicans, but I never ever voted for one. I'm a Democrat. and I was president twice of our VFW Ladies Auxiliary. And held different chairmanships and different offices there. Then I was elected district president, and then I was chosen to be on several state committees of the VFW. And I at national conventions and state conventions that I attended, then whenever they were giving awards, then through my hard work and caring and dedication, I've received many plaques and awards for first place in the nation, working with youth and Americanism, because I'm very patriotic. And with the help of our organization, I didn't do it alone. You can't do everything alone. You gotta have help. And I was a treasurer in the Fraternal Order of the Eagles and trustee. And I've worked with, I'm a charter member of the Marion County Rescue Squad. I was an EMT there. I took 6 months training over at Fairmont State College and became an EMT. And I helped them to build. And another EMT and myself delivered the first baby that it was ever born on a squad car. And it weighed 11 pounds. And I'll tell you, it was a thrill. But we were exhausted. And the mother and baby were fine. And I worked on a March of Dimes drive and a heart and a muscular dystrophy. and you know, coordinated different workers, and everything turned out that we, you know, you have to help these organizations because they do a lot of research so that maybe someday they'll have a cure. And they are making progress in cancer and the muscular dystrophy and just all many illnesses. It takes time and it takes money. And you do have to have volunteer workers. So, I just finished a Dave assisted me, my friend there, Dave Harris. And I taught in the vacation Bible school. And I had the youth, and it was really nice.
Sir, I think you must know everybody in the county or several counties around. Is that about right? Sounds like you've worked on so many things, and you say you've got